Eoch tanuyap, kuige iwans kuyens na. Hi everybody, my name is Kuige Iwans. I'm a member of the Squamish Nation and the Yagalanis clan of the Haida Nation. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. We live, work, play, and broadcast from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations.
Oh, vote, vote, vote for democracy. Vote, vote, vote for the right to be free. Yes, vote, vote, vote for democracy. Stand on guard for your country. We live in a land where people are free. We live in a place with democracy. On election day, we can all have a say in who'll lead this country. So vote, vote, vote for democracy. Vote, vote, vote for the right to be free. Yes, vote, vote, vote for democracy. Stand on guard for your country. Stand on guard for Canada.
Welcome to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection, your weekly public affairs show about the cooperative sector and social economy, proudly broadcasting on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. I'm Sandy Goldman. Tonight, we focus on the upcoming federal election. 2012 was the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives. 1 year later, the Conservative government in Ottawa dismantled the Federal Cooperative Secretariat as a cost-cutting measure. What's been the Liberal government's track record on co-ops since 2015? And what can each of us do to raise awareness of the cooperative sector with local candidates in our communities? I put those questions and others to Dan Brunet, Director of Advocacy and Partnerships for Cooperatives and Mutuals Canada. Here's our discussion.
Many things point back to the Motion 100 consultations and Motion 100 itself. So Alexandra Mendez had made a private member's bill, which received unanimous support of the House on the 5th of April, 2017. And that called on the government to recognize the important role of co-ops that they play in the economy and to take concrete steps to make sure that they continue to thrive. So as a follow-up to that, there's been many ripple effects. Former Minister Baines had done consultations across the sector and other stakeholders, and they released a big report on what they heard. StatsCan worked with ICED, Innovation Science and Economic Development Canada, to produce co-op-specific statistics. There's a training for frontline individuals involved in regional development agencies or other funding programs. The Futurepreneur program was open to co-ops. So that's part of our ongoing efforts, which sometimes link directly back to Motion M100, or sometimes they're a result of other conversations we have to unlock eligibility issues in government programs.
Great. So that co-ops can be applicants and receive the benefits of these various programs. What is left to do in terms of the Motion 100 recommendations, task force recommendations? What's still outstanding?
Well, the main thing is the actual development and support, co-creation of a national co-op development strategy. We obviously have things we'd like to see move forward, but there's been a lot of changes. As part of our advocacy priorities right now, there is a desire to bring back a co-op secretariat. So those type of things could all collaborate towards it. But the Motion 100 was quite broad, without any sort of specific deliverables. So we are using it as sort of an overarching umbrella for many of our calls and conversations, because sometimes the issues are more around awareness, and sometimes they're more sort of taxation, fiscal measures along those lines.
Are there various government programs or incentives that we've seen co-ops begin to have access to over the last 6 years?
Oh, well, yes, actually, there's been quite a number. Sort of a context-wise, co-ops should have access to all the business infrastructure and other financing of the government. When co-ops and mutuals are not eligible, that is usually not due to ill will. It's usually a sort of a lack of awareness or an omission as part of the design process to consider the unique structure of co-ops. But for example, I mentioned Futurepreneur as an entrepreneurship support program. So that was unlocked and right before the pandemic. Right. But more recently, for example, the Can Export SME program, which supports funding for small and medium enterprises that would like to develop an international strategy. We were notified by one of a frontline co-op that they had applied to the program and were told that co-ops were not eligible. So we got involved in that conversation, and that was recently sort of unlocked. Again, they can't just sort of change a word in the documents. They actually have to go through sort of government approval processes. So it's not always as fast as we'd like. But again, it was not ill will. It was just an oversight as part of the design program. So that's something we actually ask co-ops that might be listening or individuals that are aware. If you do come across any programs that state that co-ops are not eligible, do let us know, because that should not be the case anywhere. The only big difference is that for the Government of Canada, they have many programs that are split between for-profit and non-profit. And however you see in your perception on the definition of profit in a co-op world, how the government sees it is if the cooperative gives patronage dividends, it's considered a for-profit cooperative. And if it does not, it's considered a not-for-profit. So that is an area of confusion, but yes.
And I believe last year when various measures were being rolled out one after the other during the beginning of the pandemic, I can't remember what it was, but it was something that applied to banks, but not credit unions, I believe. I can't recall, but somewhere in one of my discussions around, what the last year and a bit was like, there was something that governments just didn't put out there, whereas credit unions should have been able to avail themselves, and they had to make it known to Central One. Hey, we're here too, and supporting people in our communities financially. I can't recall what program. So yeah, sometimes it's just an oversight, or again, what it comes back to is lack of awareness, right? About co-ops. Now, you mentioned reestablishing the cooperative secretariat. What was that, and why is it gone, and why do we want it back? What could it do for co-ops?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's sort of an overarching request. So context-wise, the former cooperative secretariat successfully operated for 26 years. Originally, it was under agriculture and then agriculture and agri-food Canada. So basically, it existed between 1987 and 2013. Towards the tail end of 2012, it merged with the Rural Secretariat. But basically, the whole thing was disbanded in 2013 as part of the Deficit Reduction Action Plan. It's also around that time that it had just 2012 was the International Year of Cooperatives. So there was a lot of discussions about what could or should happen going future. So it was a bit of quite a blow, to be honest. However, we are promoting that this comes back, because it could offer many advantages. For example, if we're talking about federal policies, not just a co-op development strategy, but everything around rural Canada, or the connectivity strategy and telecom co-ops, or the social innovation, social finance strategy, it would put that co-op and mutual lens on all the policies. So that internal, lens, it would also help, communication around economic opportunities and the funding programs we touched on. It would help identify and resolve barriers, so it wouldn't have to come through CMC that a co-op hit a wall. It would actually be vetted internally to make sure that things are accessible. But then there's everything else around strategies around clean tech and co-ops, or health and senior services, or daycare, which is really childcare, which is very popular as a topic right now. So the world is endless, but then there's also things around data and collaborations. So it would really be a focal point, and it would be a place where co-ops would have a designated area and people responsibility. Right now, we report to the small business branch of ICED, which is great, and they're very supportive, but it's not as broad as it could be in terms of mandate.
What has the reaction been? Obviously, or I'm assuming that CMC has been putting this request to the government, the Liberal government of the last 6 years. What's the response been to reestablishing the cooperative secretariat or something like that, so that it stands on its own representing co-ops and what co-ops can bring to the country?
Well, it's a conversation we've had with, shared or had with all the major political parties. The fact that we don't have one right now explains that, you know, that it hasn't been as fruitful as we'd have liked.
Right. But
it's also not something that's necessarily been front center as part of the conversation. It's really been in the last year and a half that the co-op, you know, the pandemic programs and the various activities have really highlighted the need for an internal advocate within government, right, and a partner to advance strategies. So that's really what brought it back to the surface, because what you mentioned around sort of credit unions and case populares not being able to enable some of the government relief programs or even co-ops being eligible for some salary top-ups early in the pandemic, those are all things we had to fight for either through CMC or through the credit unions, as you mentioned earlier.
So are any of the political parties mentioning in their platforms about reestablishing the cooperative secretariat? I'm just wondering, have you seen anything about that, or any talk of cooperatives or conversion to cooperatives or just the word co-op?
So the co-op references that are in the platforms, the Liberal, NDP, and Liberal Union Bloc platforms talk about co-op housing, which is a testament to the Cooperative Housing Federation, their advocacy, and the Vote Housing campaign, and everything else they do around that. Co-op housing is very big as a subsector, and they've really, really gotten the ear of government. So outside of that, unfortunately, we did not see any specific co-op references or mutual reference. It is something that we look for in any platform, in any fall economic statement, in any budget. We do have proposals that were that are submitted that we're waiting for information on around strategy, around conversions or the growth of platform co-ops. However, one victory which shouldn't be understated is when the government rolled out its social innovation and social finance strategy and sort of outlined the social purpose organizations that they recognized, co-ops were part of that and were very central to that conversation. So whether it's the upcoming social finance fund or the first phase of the investment readiness program, which saw 59 co-ops get $3.46 million in capacity building money, those are things, those are victories, because that's actually one where we didn't have to have co-ops recognized as part of sort of the social economy. All the people around the table saw it as a very obvious and evident thing to do. So there is progress, there's not as much as we'd like to see.
Right. I just want to clarify for our audience, did you say that the Liberals and the Bloc Québécois mentioned cooperative housing in their platforms? Can you just verify or clarify which parties you had said?
The Bloc, the NDP, and the Liberals.
The Bloc, the NDP, and the Liberals.
The Green platform has not come out yet, and unfortunately, the Conservatives did not reference.
Conservatives who had their platform out right away did not mention that. Let's go to the idea of promoting conversions to cooperatives for small and medium businesses. I know there's a co-op convert project, and CMC is part of that. And there's been a lot of talk about this as small business owners think about retirement, don't necessarily have a succession plan. There's great value to switch to the cooperative model, whether it's a worker co-op or some other kind of co-op. Tell us a bit more about the work that's being done around that going forward.
Yes, certainly. The Conversion to Cooperatives Project was a three-year Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council-funded program to basically look at the Conversion to Cooperatives landscape in Canada. So a group of researchers led by Dr. Marcelo Vieira and also led by Fiona Duguid, Dr. Fiona Duguid and Dr. Kilnadi Gyat were basically the core team, along with some very, very strong graduate students and postdoctoral students, basically did an inventory of conversions in Canada. Those are actually all accessible on the CMC map of co-ops and mutuals in Canada. You can go in and click a button and the ones that we know have popped out. But more importantly, they also did a survey of small business owners, and they also did a number of case studies, which honestly should be published around the 15th of September. That's great. The big sort of release. So I encourage everybody to keep an eye on that, because it's great, not from only from a co-op point of view, but from an awareness as a way to not only, as you pointed out, address the succession planning gap, but also how to keep businesses and other co-op enterprises alive, you know, in the pandemic or post-pandemic, because obviously they felt quite a strain.
So are you telling me that, or telling us that, in fact, that is happening across the country, that that's what we can look forward to reading about in the in this report from Co-op Convert?
Actually, it's going to be more than a report. There's a small business survey. The website is available now with some information, but all the right. case studies and the public release is, in a week and a half or two, you should see a lot of information, because it is a signature research piece that's been in the works for quite a long time, and it'll be available in both languages, and some great case studies on co-ops specifically in various regions.
And I've had a quick look at their website. There's a lot of information there and a lot of resources for businesses that are, you know, thinking about moving into using the cooperative model. And this is exceptionally important in rural Canada to, you know, keep the local ice cream shop alive. I know there's an ice cream shop in New Brunswick near Sackville that converted to a co-op, or the local movie theater, for example, in Campbellford, Ontario, the Aaron Theater and that. So yes. The communities get involved, and it's wonderful both for community participation and a feeling of being part of something and keeping a business, a necessary business. You got to say ice cream's necessary for sure, alive and available to people. Let's look at co-ops and the pandemic. We know that co-ops, we think, fared quite well in terms of at least pivoting and adapting right away to serve their members and taking care of their members. And we know this from the series produced by the Center for the Study of Cooperatives at USASC, the Canadian Center for the Study of Cooperatives, their series Co-ops in a Time of Crisis. So many of the credit unions and FCL, co-op stores and others across the country really, went to bat for their members to take care of them in a very uncertain time. CMC also wants to generate more research on how the pandemic affected co-ops. So tell us about that exciting work.
Well, absolutely. There's a lot of work that's been done already, a lot of articles. We wanted to have a sort of an overarching view of co-ops and the pandemic's impact on co-ops and mutuals. So we actually commissioned sort of a five-part research project. The first was basically setting the benchmark. So a literature review on co-op responses to historical crisis, be it the financial crash and so on. The second part was really looking at the media stories and other research that was going on specifically around co-op and the pandemic. The third part, which is ground truthing, was basically surveys and key stakeholder interviews to see how exactly they pivoted, how they took advantage of government programs, be it at the federal, municipal, or provincial level. That's actually something where the survey is still open. If anybody listening has not had a chance to complete it yet, I would encourage that they do so. There's an economic impact study that's going to be done, looking at 2019 and 2020, just to see the trend and number of co-ops that were established or closed and things like that. So those will also be compared with the Canadian economy as a whole. So that'll give us a good sense of, we believe and we know, and there's a lot of information about co-op resiliency, but has that been proven true through the pandemic as well? And all that's going to come together in a big final report that should be in Q4 or the last part of 2022, with many things being released before that.
And again, this is these results, which I think will prove the resilience of co-ops through the pandemic, is another piece that you can use to advocate with the government for this co-op secretariat, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's all, you can see how one thing leads to another, and it's important. And so if cooperatives want to do this, fill out the survey, how can they access it?
Well, they could reach out to me directly. It's also, I'm happy to share it with you, Sandy, and you can share it if people ask. Yes. However, it has been communicated on social media and various locations, but it is readily accessible, the COVID survey. But I invite anybody to contact CMC, and we'll be happy to share the link directly rather than have somebody sort of poking around a website.
Okay, because that's important. Now, getting back to the federal election, how is CMC going to support cooperatives across the country with questions or asks from co-op that they can use in their all candidates meetings or town halls or things like that? Because again, raising public awareness at the local level is hopefully going to filter up, and we have to do it candidate by candidate. So how is CMC going to support us through the next number of days to ask questions?
That's a great point, Sandy. And there is a document that's going to be going out in the coming days to all the co-ops that we have an email for across Canada, which will basically be a synopsis of the bullet point overview of the platforms and the co-op links, but more importantly, how can co-ops leverage the current election period as a means to raise awareness? And really, that comes down to three bubbles. The first is sort of the grassroots advocacy, which you just touched on, and it's going to the candidate meetings or when somebody is canvassing door to door for a candidate. One simple question, which is, what is your party's position in regards to cooperatives mutuals? They may not have an answer specifically, but politicians hate not having an answer, so that will feed back up the policy or the discussion chain, and will actually hopefully sort of sandwich the candidates between the work we've done in engaging political parties and the platform folks and what's going on the front line. So there's without going into too many big questions, the simple one line question about the party's position in regards to cooperatives and mutuals can have a lot of impact. The second one is the sharing of links or speeches or questions with CMC and provincial and territorial associations. For example, if a Deputy Prime Minister just posted a social media tweet about how, her parents founded a co-op housing project and that's where she grew up, that's actually some information we were not aware of until it was posted. Now, we saw that one and we monitor social media, but if anybody, a candidate or an incumbent or gets into a speech or conversation or makes any reference to co-ops, we track those because whether they're elected or not, they might become champions within the House of Commons or influencers within the party in terms of moving our advocacy and awareness agenda forward. Because nothing is more powerful than a real life example of somebody next door. And the third one is if somebody is interested in being a bit more involved, or they either have an interest or have experience in government relations or have very close relationships with candidates, CMC's and the sector's priorities are listed on our website on the CMC website. And all they have to do basically is go familiarize themselves with those and share them wide and share them strategically with candidates. They don't necessarily need to speak to them because most people might not feel comfortable talking about, the small business deduction and the impact of the impact it has on the non-agriculture or fisheries cooperative, right? But just knowing that there's an issue around the small business tax, is good to know. So I do invite people to go out or to contact me if they'd like more information. But if also if they're going into a strategic meeting, we can share with them the list of all the co-ops in a specific riding, or the map of co-ops and mutuals in Canada is accessible to the public. Somebody can just zoom in and what are the co-ops next door and whether they use it for the election or for their own co-op to co-op procurement for events and products. That's a whole other ripple effect.
Right. So there's lots that we can do. And that's wonderful to empower cooperators. And again, it always comes back to raising public awareness of the cooperative model. The work that cooperators are going to do, that CMC is going to do, I know will continue regardless of the outcome of the federal election. What is the big task going forward? Let's say for the next 6 months, regardless of who is elected for CMC on behalf of cooperators, what do you have your eye on?
Well, our priorities will not change with regardless of what government is there. So we do have sort of six major priorities: the return of the co-op secretariat, the encouraging business conversions to co-ops, and from a fiscal measures point of view, making sure that all co-op entrepreneurs have access to the small business deduction, that the tax-deferred cooperative share program as a capitalization method is permanently enshrined. We'd like to see a federal cooperative investment plan like there is in Quebec, which, the Quebec social economy and co-op sector is fantastic, and that is a good tool for it. It basically provides tax incentives to investors in co-ops. And lastly, we'd like to see the fair tax treatment for fair public policy for co-ops that have an indivisible reserve. Whether that's mandatory or adopted by irrevocable choice of the co-op. But those are really our priorities. So once the new government is in place, once the ministers are in place, we will focus on onboarding and meeting those individuals and laying out the importance of these projects and why, but also continuing to work with the various individuals and departments. For example, the Center for Rural Economic Development, CENRED, which is actually the new version of our former sister rural secretariat from back in the day. Their co-ops are omnipresent in rural
Canada.
So agriculture and retail and many other aspects. So we do have a lot of allies within the government. It would be helpful to have a more holistic strategy rather than sort of piecemeal ad hoc, based on who we've been able to raise awareness with or convince.
So there's something for all of us to do, all cooperators, during this election period. And thank you, Daniel, for telling us the work of CMC in terms of advocacy and raising public awareness with the government and across all parties of the cooperative model and its strengths. And we really, we appreciate that. And we wish you all the best going forward, and we'll be looking for the tips on what we can do in the days ahead, and we'll keep on going because we believe in the cooperative model. So thanks so much, Dan. All the best going forward, and thank you to everyone there at CMC. Be well.
Thank you, Sandy. And if anybody's got questions, it's dbrunette@canada.coop, and I invite you to contact me with anything.
Great. We'll have that on our website. Thanks so much, Dan. Bye now.
That was Dan Brunet, Director of Advocacy and Partnerships for Co-ops and Mutuals Canada. We'll have CMC's tips for co-op advocacy and a link to the co-ops and COVID survey on our website, eachforall.coop. Let's take a break, then come back with more of tonight's program.
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana, and you're listening on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio. Keep on listening, baby.
Give me that.
It's mine.
I want it.
No, it's mine.
No, give it to me.
You have to give it back.
Stop. Instead of fighting, try working together. Honestly, openly, in a spirit of caring for others. And tune in to Each for All, The Cooperative Connection. Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. on CFRO 100.5 FM, on your dial and online at cooperadio.org. Try cooperating. You'll feel better for it.
¶¶ I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
And we're back. You're listening to Each for All, the Cooperative Connection on Vancouver Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, and online at cooperadio.org. Canada is a first world country, yet homelessness continues to grow, and safe, affordable housing remains out of reach for an increasing number of people. How did this happen? What choices did governments make in the past that got us to where we are now? And what different choices can be made for the future? That's what the Vote Housing campaign has put on the table, inviting all of us to make our voices heard. Tom Armstrong is the Chief Executive Officer of the Cooperative Housing Federation. We talked about Vote Housing and how we got here. Have a listen.
Just as soon as the writ dropped, I also received information about a Vote Housing campaign. Honestly, it seemed like the same day. And it's been front and center. Tell us a bit about, I know there's been lobbying and pushing for years and years to create safe, affordable housing to end homelessness. But this time the campaign seems highly organized and right out there for everyone to see. And of course, leaders are talking about this. Everyone's talking about it because it's such a dire situation. So tell us about the campaign. What it sets out to do. Let's start there.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you introduce it that way, because that's exactly what the organizers had in mind. I think it's probably fair to say that the co-op housing sector and the broader community housing sector has been pretty effective in getting its message in front of government and the media and the public in different election campaigns. And we always had the sense that there's more there to be done. So this time, some of the apex organizations in the housing sector, the Co-op Housing Federation of Canada, the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness, and the Canadian Housing and Renewal Association, kind of put their heads together and said, what if we organized a broad-based, grassroots, nonpartisan campaign to raise awareness and mobilize people around the issues and actions that would actually solve the housing crisis and end homelessness and address housing need in Canada. And that was really the genesis of the Vote Housing campaign. It's a highly organized virtual based campaign that reaches out to people on a very clear platform of ideas that says, homelessness and the housing crisis we're in is a policy choice that's been made, and we need to make different choices. And the housing crisis is solvable, and here are the concrete measures that we think need to be taken to solve it. And I have to admit that I was not I didn't know. I was quite uncertain how the messaging would be received and how much traction the campaign would get. But, the Co-op Housing Federation and the BC Nonprofit Housing Association and the Aboriginal Housing Management Association, the three of our organizations got together before the campaign was launched. And we said to ourselves and each other, this is an opportunity to make a real difference. So we threw our weight and our financial resources behind the campaign with our national partners. And the outcome is exactly what you described. And I'm thrilled to hear you describe it in that way, because that was exactly the goal.
Now, before we break down what the your platform, you have a number of key points, key asks. I'd like you to trace the history of public policy around housing that has led us to a terrible situation of homelessness and lack of affordable housing, because it wasn't always that way. So can you set some context? What were the policy decisions made by the federal government, and when did they occur? Can you just give us a history lesson, please?
Well, I'm glad that you're approaching it that way, because you're right. It hasn't always been this way. I mean, you know, broadly speaking, Canadians are a well-housed population, but you know, around the edges of the market, and now penetrating much more deeply into every income cohort in our society, you know, and especially laid bare by the extreme conditions of the pandemic, housing inequity and other social and economic inequities have really become so much more pronounced. So, you know, back in the 80s, there was a move to reduce spending on a variety of social initiatives, and that, you know, you saw that really with the election of the Mulroney government in 1984. It goes quite a ways back, and you know, there had been a lot of emphasis on reducing the debt and the deficit, and that led to a trend to start reducing expenses. But the real, you know, the real turning point, I think, in a lot of people's eyes, was the complete vacating of the social housing scene by the federal government in the early 90s. And that, you know, there was a kind of the perfect storm of a constitutional discussion around, you know, where the jurisdiction for housing should lie. It's all, I mean, it's in the constitution of provincial jurisdiction, but the federal government had always spent freely in that space, both independently and in partnership with the provinces to, especially, you know, since the end of the Second World War, to generate, a more ample supply of rental and owned housing in the country. But, you know, in the early 90s, the federal government said, I think, took advantage of that constitutional discussion to achieve some of its financial priorities. And they said to the provinces, okay, you want it, you've got it. We're devolving housing, and we're getting out of the game. So they devolved the responsibility, but they didn't devolve the resources needed to fully address it. And that was the beginning of the fraying of the social safety net that was bound up in our housing policy. And it left provinces, you know, really with the job of dealing with a responsibility they had previously cost-shared with the federal government. So some of them responded by saying, well, if the federal government can download it to the provinces, this was the what happened in Ontario under Mike Harris, they said, well, we can devolve it to the municipalities. Mm-hmm. So now you had a province, the biggest province in the country, trying to fund social housing policy on the municipal property tax base, which of course the outcome was a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
Only, you know, really BC and Quebec made an attempt, you know, through the balance of the 90s and early into the 2000s to fill some of that gap, never as successfully as when the federal government was a partner in the effort. And, you know, provinces have had their own fiscal pressures and their own social and financial priorities, and housing doesn't always shoot right to the top of everyone's wish list on where spending should be allocated. So I think, you know, that early 90s, that was really the fork in the road. And it's only become worse since then as a result of pressures like the increased financialization of housing and the dramatic disconnect between housing costs and average and median incomes in the country. So you see now in BC, a situation where, you know, almost half of renters are paying more than 30% of their income on housing, and one in five renters is paying more than half of their income on housing. And that is crisis level spending when it comes to leaving enough money left over to live a reasonable life, to put food on the table, to provide medicine for kids, to get childcare. It just puts so many of what other people might think of as life's necessities, literally out of reach of dramatic swaths of the population. So, and as I said earlier, those inequities have only become more pronounced in the course of the pandemic, and that has really laid bare the impact of those early decisions in the 90s.
So what are the key points of the vote housing platform? And then we'll talk about what the federal parties have been proposing. And also, I want to talk about the track record of the Liberal government's federal housing strategy since 2015. But let's start about with the platform.
Well, we have a list of six major areas. And the first, and I'm so glad that all of the partners in the campaign agreed that this was the first. We have to implement finally and conclusively an urban, rural, and northern indigenous housing strategy that has dedicated investments in that housing and an indigenous-led governance structure. So for indigenous, by indigenous housing. There has been no dedicated federal strategy to address this crying need. And we know that indigenous peoples disproportionately experience homelessness. We know that one in 15 indigenous peoples in urban centers are going to experience homelessness in Canada compared to one in 128 for the general population. They disproportionately live in housing that's unaffordable, overcrowded, not culturally appropriate, and or needs major repairs. And that's simply unacceptable. And there has been no concerted federal initiative to address that ever. So that's the first in the platform. The second is a pretty bold statement, I think. and because you'll hear in a lot of housing policy discussions, well, how can we reduce the impact or mitigate the impact of homelessness? How can we slow the increase in homelessness as if a certain level of homelessness would be somehow acceptable in our, you know, one of the richest countries in the world? So the second goal in the platform is to commit to the elimination of homelessness and the prevention of any reemergence of that phenomenon. We know that more than 235,000 people in Canada experience homelessness in any given year, 35,000 on any given night. Almost 2 million Canadians have experienced homelessness at some point in their lives. It's unacceptable. And a growing number of communities across North America are having a fair degree of success as they apply a housing first policy lens to that question of homelessness, to reducing or even ending it. And that has to be a top priority in the platform. Supportive housing. We need a minimum of 50,000 units of supportive housing over the next decade. We know the pressures that drive people into homelessness are sometimes overpowering. And the wraparound supports that need to be applied to people who are in a very precarious position and more at risk of becoming homeless needs to be a permanent part of our housing system. And then we need to add many, many more affordable non-market co-op and nonprofit homes, a minimum of 300,000 homes over the next decade. There's just simply are not enough affordable, accessible housing options for Canadians. That has to be addressed. And lastly, we need to figure out how to curtail the impact of the financialization of our rental housing markets and reduce the impact of treating housing as an investment in somebody's portfolio that's expected to return, double digit appreciation or equity to their bottom line. And lastly, low-income households need a much expanded, more robust program for rental assistance to reduce their housing costs, give them resources to live a reasonable life, and prevent what we fear might be a new wave of homelessness that arises from the pandemic and its impact. So that's really the platform. I know it's a lot to swallow all at once, but housing is a complex public policy issue, and treating it as a single issue crisis or challenge hasn't got us anywhere. And we think this broad-based, comprehensive platform is what's needed to tackle it in Canada, and not just in big urban centers, but also in rural and northern centers, where in proportionally housing and homelessness are as big a problem as anywhere else.
Absolutely. So as you've looked over the platforms of the major parties, what are you seeing? And are you hearing anything that aligns with the vote housing platform in any way, shape, or form?
We're hearing quite a bit. In fact, I might even go as far as to say we're hearing more than we expected to hear. But I'm also noticing another issue or challenge that's emerging. So if you look across the the Liberal, the NDP, the Conservative, and the Bloc Québécois platforms, I haven't seen what the Greens are proposing yet. We hope to very, very soon. You see bits and pieces of all of the platform that vote housing is advancing. the one thing I would say about all of them is they still, and I get this because the majority of Canadians are living in homes they own. So as a voting pool, you can't afford to ignore them. But there's still too much attention paid to increasing subsidies to homeowners and supporting home ownership as opposed to the rental market, which is where the crisis of supply and affordability is most acute. And the other, the other big challenge that we're seeing is that, you can advance a platform that has, the biggest and best targets for new homes and preserving existing homes that you can imagine. But if you haven't figured out how to mobilize the resources you have to actually deliver those homes, and in the case of the federal government, we're talking about Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, which has spent less than half of the money that it's been allocated to date to deliver on the national housing strategy, then all you've got at the end of the day is a housing platform and not a housing program. And that's to me where the rubber really hits the road. And I don't, frankly, hear any party, maybe they would say, this isn't, it's not appropriate to get into the weeds on something like this in an election campaign. I would say it's exactly the time to tell us, thanks for the promise. How do you plan to deliver on it? And I don't see anybody with a convincing proposal about how they're going to mobilize the resources they have to be more effective than they have been so far.
Let me ask you about the National Housing Strategy, because we've talked about that a great deal over the last number of years on Each for All. How do you rate that in terms of achieving some of the goals that are within the Vote Housing platform? And what has it been like over the last 6 years under the Liberal government?
Well, we said from the very beginning when the National Housing Strategy was announced, well, the first thing we said was, welcome back to the federal government. And that's, I guess, a piece that is quite often overlooked when people talk about the National Housing Strategy. It is significant that the federal government said, we're back. We're back at the table. We've turned the corner on the early 90s, and here we are again, ready to make a significant contribution. So, I'll give them that's hugely important. But then in terms of the flow of money, they backloaded it so that most of it came even after this election, in the very latter years of the strategy. And, we had a housing crisis on day one of the National Housing Strategy. So why wait? Unless it was an implicit acknowledgement that they didn't really have the horses in the stable to deliver on the homes that they were promising in those, that series of budgets. So again, it's not a one size fits all analysis. I'd say that on the question of the Rapid Housing Initiative and the, partnering with municipalities to get temporary and modular housing into the ground quickly to address the issue of homelessness or people on the cusp of homelessness, that actually has been a fairly dramatic success. We need more and we need it more quickly. I think everyone would agree, but as a first step, that Rapid Housing Initiative has proven to be a reliable way of getting significant amounts of money straight to the municipal level where it can be spent effectively to address housing need. So, you know, kudos for that. You know, the supply stimulation initiatives have really turned out to be much more effective for private sector developers than they have community housing sector developers. Our community land trust has used the rental housing construction initiative on one co-op, but it's been very, very difficult for nonprofits and co-ops with without as much capacity to find the security for the financing needed to make that program work truly effectively for them. So it hasn't. And then, you know, finally, the big gaping hole, the co-investment fund was really the piece of the strategy that was meant to introduce new community housing supply into the market. And that's where they have managed to spend less than half of the money that was allocated. And it's worked particularly poorly in BC, just based on the program design and the way you accumulate points to, you know, enhance the chances of an application being approved. I'd have to say that that was meant to be the centerpiece of the social housing supply initiative, and it's been a bust in BC, and no sign at all of it in improving. And that's why I said, a few minutes ago, that it's one thing to have a platform and a big number as your objectives. If you don't have the delivery system to make that happen, it's just empty promises.
And so we're not hearing about an actual delivery system in any of the platforms for this current election. Are you getting those kind of details?
No. They I think everybody would just say we're going to allocate the resources to CMHC that will be needed to make those turn those numbers or those promises into homes. We have never seen that happen. I don't know any reason why we should expect it to be different.
Let me ask you this. You say the federal government came back with this national housing strategy after an absence of many, many years in the early 90s. So they're back. Do you think that it should be a federal, that the federal government, the provincial government, the municipal governments have to come together in a more coordinated way, because each have their roles when it comes to housing and, you know, create a housing table, so to speak, and just become more coordinated and figure out who's going to do what and get things done. I mean, if the federal government is actually back with the money, that's great. But do you know what I'm saying? Because I've heard this referred to over the last little while, that there needs to be more coordination.
Well, just on that basis, you should be the Minister of Housing, because that's exactly what has to happen, and it's what hasn't happened. The federal and provincial programs don't play well together. It's very hard to fit them into the kind of coherent approach you'd need to make the kind of impact we're looking for, and no one wants to tackle the big elephant in the room, which is that you can't force municipal governments to use their zoning powers to incent the production and operation of community housing unless they really want to, and too many of them don't really want to, and that's a vexing political problem that I know is top of mind for provincial officials, and it's even something that federal officials will talk about consistently, but nobody has figured out the right combination of carrot and stick to make things happen at the municipal level that we think need to happen.
So, for example, if there's a community where a housing initiative is proposed, a social housing initiative or a co-op or something that is more affordable, deeply affordable, and community members who have single family homes, their equity, whatever, we hear this in many cases, it becomes a case of NIMBYism, and the zoning is such that they're going to fight that, and that just takes us nowhere. And I guess it would be the province that would have to amend the laws or the municipal act or something like that. And then you get into a whole situation. But the people in the downtown east side, for example, who are just living in some of the worst, yes, they're out of the encampments. And I know there's been a lot of work done by the provincial government and the city of Vancouver, but they've gone from, you know, living outside in also horrible situations into these SROs, which are just tragic. What's the solution there? I know the city has bought up properties, some of these old hotels along the way. The old Army and Navy is trying to put something together for people, but it just can't happen fast enough.
No, you're right. And you know, I live just a few blocks away and I see it every day, and it's tragic. It's heartbreaking. And you know, if the pandemic has taught us one thing, it's that these, you know, the problems we have and the most acute problems are policy choices, and we need to make different choices. And we saw the purchase of hotels have a real impact on the situation, but not the impact that everyone was hoping for, because the budget was squeezed, the resources to operate that housing with the appropriate wraparound supports that wouldn't leave, you know, wouldn't say to people, here's your new home, hope it works out for you. That was a recipe for disaster, and we've seen some unfortunate outcomes of that approach. But by and large, you know, I think it's a positive direction if we put enough resources into it. But you know, you're right, the municipal approval process is fraught. You know, the political dynamic there is very unhealthy. SFU is undertaking a really interesting study of the biases that are deeply ingrained in the current public hearing process, and what could be done to rehabilitate the public hearing process or the public engagement process, so that the balance of interest wouldn't be so heavily weighted to work people who already have the kind of privilege that allows them to influence municipal governments, often to the detriment of community housing applications. And I'm following that very closely, because I think it's a bold and a brave approach. It'll be up to the province, because legally speaking, the municipalities are creatures of the province. It'll be up to the province to decide how assertive it wants to be in mandating approaches to housing at the municipal level that will deliver results that we desperately need, and not just in big urban centers, right, all over the province, because this is a problem that afflicts every corner of BC and by extension Canada.
We really appreciate the effort of everyone involved here, and hope folks will be asking at the door or in other ways online, so that we can make this an absolute priority going forward. Thanks so much, Tom.
And thank you. Thanks so much for your focus on it. And then let's remember that in that tapestry of housing, co-ops are still the best kept secret in the housing sector. And we want to build many, many more co-op homes over the next decade.
Absolutely. Okay, Tom, thanks so much. Keep up the good fight, and we'll be in touch. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
That was Tom Armstrong, Chief Executive Officer of the Cooperative Housing Federation of BC. For further information on how you can get involved to support safe, affordable housing in Canada, go to votehousing.ca. That's it for tonight's edition of Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. A big thank you to my fellow cooperator, Robin Puga, for putting all the pieces together. And a reminder, advance voting begins September 10th and runs through September 13th. General voting day is Monday, September 20th. If you would like to vote by mail, you need to apply by Tuesday, September 14th at 6 p.m. Go to elections.ca for further details. I'm Sandy Goldman. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and have a cooperative week.